This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Marketers, are you ready to make an impact with audio advertising?
People are hungry for authentic connections in a world buzzing all around us. How do you cut through the noise and truly reach your audience?
Visit stateofaudio.com to see Odyssey's State of Audio, the Trends Report. Uncover the secrets to high-impact creative.
Learn how AI is revolutionizing the industry. And get ahead of the curve on measurement and audience trends. Don't just stay in the game. Win it. Visit stateofaudio.com and download your free copy.
6:15 on this Monday, President's Day. One person texts us on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870 with an answer to why we have mattress sales on President's Day. They say that was the best way to honor Bill Clinton. I see what you did there, but I think mattress sales on President's Day predate his presidency. In fact, it was back in 1971 that they started this whole President's Day thing. What makes for a great president? I thought that'd be a good question on this President's Day. So we asked Michael Frawley to join us, a historian who has studied the presidents throughout time. He's an associate professor of history and a dean at the University of Texas, Permian Basin. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I am wonderful. It's President's Day, and
is this
I'm
like your Christmas?
Like lots of people. So
is this like your Christmas? President's Day is the day that honors, you know, what you study as a professor and a historian?
Yeah, it's a good one. So, I like this one.
What makes a president great? You know, I think obviously that's very subjective, and the voters have throughout history had different thoughts on who should be president and why. But if you look through history for trends and try to understand what has made the best presidents of the United States the best, are there any common threads that you see?
I really think it's the ability to rise to the challenge of the time. You know, no president knows what they're going to face 100% when they go into office. Many of them, when they run, if a president runs on a domestic platform, we're going to do these great things for the country. All of the problems that they have to face while they're in office end up being foreign. And if they run on a foreign affairs platform, it ends up being domestic issues.
Murphy's Law, yeah.
So it really is the ability, I think, to meet the challenges that come with that. And sometimes it is really hard to tell who's going to be the guy to do that and do that well.
And when you look throughout time, who has faced the biggest challenges and who do you think has risen to the occasion best amongst them?
I mean, the easiest one, of course, is you'll say George Washington. Someone like Abraham Lincoln, of course. But then there are others that, you know, Herbert Hoover on paper looked like an amazing president. Like, he had all the qualifications you were going to want a guy for that office to have. And he got smacked with the Great Depression and had no idea how to deal with it or deal with it well. So, I mean, I really think that's what you get when you're looking for those presidents. Abraham Lincoln knew what he was going to face when he came into office, but no one saw the Civil War coming the way it came.
And then
he had to adjust and deal, and he did it well.
you talked about Hoover and his failings due to the Depression, but then FDR comes in knowing he has to solve the Depression and rises to that occasion, but then he's there forever and has World War II to deal with as well. So he proved to be successful domestically and internationally.
Yeah, I mean, it did help. You know, a war does help to jar domestic economy and production. So that really did help him. But he had a plan when he went in. I mean, he's one of the rare ones that was able to handle both. And you've got someone like Lyndon Johnson, who came in with his Great Society wanting to fix the country domestically and had a strong plan for it. And then Vietnam derails him completely, and we lose a lot of great ideas and programs that he put forward because he got sucked into something else completely. So, you know, it really is just waiting for history to judge.
Has it always been, though, that presidents have to focus almost all of their energies on one or the other, a huge domestic agenda or issues to solve domestically, or an international agenda, typically involving war, that keeps them from being able to do a whole lot at home?
Really, since about World War I, yeah, because of how complex they now. There are other presidents. My favorite president is James K. Polk. He had two platforms. He had two planks in his platform that he ran on. He did both of those and then went home and retired. I will take a president that does the two things he promises and then goes home.
Polk. Rarely do you say anyone say, yeah, my favorite president was Polk, but few of us study it like you do. So that's interesting. I'm going to push the pause button right there. When we come back, I want to talk about more modern presidents that folks listening now may have actually lived through an experience and what has made them great or not so great. I'll also tell you my thoughts on what makes for a great president, and it may be a little different than what others have in mind. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. We're back with Professor Frawley after this, ranking the U.S. presidents on WWL. Right now, we got to get a look at traffic. 6:24, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker on this President's Day. Don't expect to get any mail today, and your bank's probably closed. That's how we honor presidents. Oh, and mattresses are on sale here on President's Day. Not sure how that became a thing, but it is. Michael Frawley is our guest, professor of history and dean at the University of Texas Permian Basin. He's a presidential historian. And I wanted to talk, Professor, a little bit about more modern presidents and who ranked the highest. To me, it's always been who acts the most presidential that always influenced me the most. I thought that Ronald Reagan kind of set the stage by using his acting skills to come off as looking and feeling and acting like the president. And he seemed to really grab the nation's attention. And you just felt like, now there's a president, whether you liked his policies or not. We've had some presidents since who maybe didn't come off so presidential.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a more modern trend. Reagan was a great president for the American people. Like, people looked up to him. He felt like a president every time he came on television. And the backdrop of the things he was dealing with, you know, he was the face you wanted for that fight to end the Cold War and to bring down communism. You know, he had been such a public figure for so long that when he translated to the presidential office, like you said, the skills that he had carried him through. And I think of a modern, when we think of the gravitas of a modern president, that's who we think of. And the presidents since him have had their moments, but no one like he did.
You know, television, obviously, and then most people listening don't remember life without television, but historians will tell you that television clearly changed the presidency of the United States. Once people could see the president, not only hear them on the radio or read about them in print, it really did kind of change what people looked for in a president, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when JFK was elected, the great debate between him and Nixon that really turned that election. If you're an American who listened to it on the radio, you thought Nixon won that based on his ideas and what he said. But if you watched it on television, JFK, according to people, clearly won it. Nixon was sweating. He didn't look presidential.
He had a stubbly growth on his face. He hadn't shaved before he went on TV.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, TV has, and now we've got, I mean, it's not even just a 24-hour news cycle, it's a 24-second news cycle, the way social media works.
And that was where I wanted to go next. As much as television changed the way people choose and think of presidents, now social media clearly was a tool very well used by Donald Trump in winning both of his presidencies. He was able to connect almost individually with so many Americans that became huge supporters of him, largely because of his social media posts. That's also clearly changing the way we pick a president, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's not just he was able to harness that, then his followers became an extension of that harnessing so that he created a web. So an idea wouldn't just hit the people who are paying attention to it now. It would echo through social media so well that people would connect with him, and it makes single issue voting easier for political parties to be able to make use of because of the 10 and 15 and 20 second sound bite.
And it also harkens back to many, many before any of us were alive, the way politics maybe was done back then, where there wasn't the fact checking of television and radio journalists and print journalists and internet journalists that there is now. Social media allows candidates to make claims and to put information out there that is able, because of the nature of social media, to bypass the fact checkers. And maybe it's true, maybe it's not. But if it resonates with your base, it wins you support.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we grew out of an era where, you know, newspapers and things like that were owned by political parties. We got out of that to a more professional journalism, and now we're going back to more partisan-driven attempts to reach out to people, which it's very common throughout
propaganda.
American
history. We can call it propaganda, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, it depends on what we're talking about. I mean, some of it's going to be propaganda. Some of it's just going to be what a political party believes. And, you know, it may not be propaganda. It just may be platform. But, yeah, no, you're right. And that propaganda and those ideas can just get a lot more traction, especially in ways we never imagine how they're going to get traction. You never know what's going to go viral.
Professor Frawley, we've run out of time, but before we let you run, is there anything else on this President's Day you, as being a presidential historian, would like to share with our audience?
You know, it's just the idea of the office of the presidency is just so important in American history and in American society, and getting out and voting every time that you can, especially in presidential elections, to make your voice heard so that the man in the White House represents you.
And we say, man, do you anticipate we will see a woman in the White House in our lifetimes?
Absolutely. I keep telling myself that. And one will come along that is as electable as anybody else.
Yeah, so far the argument is we just haven't had the right candidates. Thank you, Professor. Enjoy President's Day. We appreciate your joining us here on WWL. Mike Dottilier joins us after the news. 6:43, good morning. Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker on this President's Day. Mike Dottilier, WWL NFL analyst and co-host of Sports Talk, joins us. Morning, Mike. Happy President's Day.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Dave.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to observe it, so we'll just say that and leave that there. Kellen Moore was announced last week as the new coach of the New Orleans Saints. Had to go back to Philadelphia to participate in the Super Bowl victory parade. But even through that and then coming back here to New Orleans, clearly he's been focused on putting his staff together to coach this next iteration of the New Orleans Saints. What are we hearing and what are you thinking about what you've seen so far out of Coach Moore?
Yeah, you got a little bit of a late start here because of the Super Bowl, but you want to get your staff in place because later in the month is the NFL Combine. And so you want to have your staff set by the time that occurs later in February. It looks as though the big hires, will come pretty quickly at offensive defensive coordinator. It always had been rumored that Brandon Staley, the former head coach of the L.A. Chargers, who was with the 49ers last year, they'll have an interview with him for the defensive coordinator's job. And Doug Nussmeier, who was a former Saints quarterback, who was bounced around the college and pro football world. When you're a coach, you're somewhat like in the surface, man. You're going here and there and all over. And he'll also come in. Now, the one thing with Kellen Moore, he has made it pretty plain that no matter who he hires as his offensive coordinator, he is going to call the plays on offense. So the big hires is really on the defensive side of the football. That's where I think you'll see something occur pretty quickly, because I think he had pretty much zeroed in on Nussmeier and Brandon Staley. Even before he got the job, there were a lot of rumors going around about that.
So much like we saw under Sean Payton, you expect that Moore will be pretty much running the offense and will leave the defensive side of things up to somebody else. How do you feel about that approach in terms of success we've seen throughout the NFL on coaches calling their own plays on offense?
Well, one, you don't know both sides of the ball. So you try to get somebody with Kellen Moore's spot. He wants somebody defensively that can kind of run the show. That you pretty much the head coach of the defense, and he runs the offensive side of the football. Even Sean Payton here sort of gave sometimes the duties over to Pete Carmichael, but Sean still had his hands involved with everything. And he also had Drew Brees for a long period of time. And Drew and Sean almost, they kind of shared the same brain of calling plays. So, whatever you feel comfortable with is how you should run it. Because I've seen defensive coaches the exact same way. They want to call the plays. And whatever you feel comfortable with, that's what you have to go with. And with Kellen Moore, he knows one thing. He's going to be judged on wins and losses, nothing else. And if he feels as though him calling the plays gets him more wins, that's what he's going to do. It's just preference on how you want to handle things.
And we've seen that work well here, and you kind of led me right into the next question. Sean Payton had Drew Brees. Drew Brees was always given options by Sean Payton of which play to run, and clearly there was a lot of audibling going on and reading of the defense and so on and so forth. What is Kellen Moore needs that in a quarterback as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't have that pretty much in place. And, we've seen other teams make a quick turnaround, but they had the right guy in at the most critical position at quarterback. 2 years ago, we saw the Houston Texans, who were flatlined as a football team, but they picked C.J. Stroud. And C.J. was unbelievable what he did 2 years ago as a rookie quarterback. And last year, Jaden Daniels with the Commanders. Okay, that's an anomaly. That doesn't happen all the time. With Sean, he was lucky, and there's always a little bit of that in this game, that Drew Brees became available. Now, a lot of that certainly was because of the injury he suffered with his shoulder out in San Diego. But Coach Payton, at first was trying to trade for Tony Romo. Tony wasn't the starter back then, and he was trying to deal for Tony Romo.
Payton knew him from Dallas when he was an assistant coach there.
Exactly. And so there's always a connect the dot, and I think the same way applies to assistant coaches, Dave, that there's always a connection. Now, I've talked to enough coaches that say, okay, you get a job, you get the head coaching job, and you have a pretty good idea of assistant coaches. Did anybody you've either talked to or had even the smallest sort of connection with reach out to you if they think it's a better job and it pays more? So you sort of got to deal with a lot of that. That's the part of being a head coach. As an assistant, you didn't have to deal with that. As a head coach, yes. But that quarterback position, and that's something that, you know, still to be determined on how that gets handled with this football team for 2025.
Talking with Mike Dettillier, when we get back, I want to talk to him about what he thinks. We have seen, typically, now, maybe Peyton's first choice wasn't Drew Brees, maybe it was Tony Romo, but ultimately he got his guy. Who is going to be Kellen Moore's guy? Who does he think will be the quarterback that teams up with the coach to try and bring success to this New Orleans Saints team? And does it happen this year? Do we have to wait another year? Do we have to put more, a few more miles on the car before we can trade it in for a different model? We'll talk to Mike about that coming up next here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker on President's Day. Who would you like to see the quarterback be for the New Orleans Saints? Text me now, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text line while we check on traffic. It was a busy weekend for the new Saints coach, Kellen Moore, after being announced formally to the Houdat Nation. He had to go back to Philadelphia to participate in the Super Bowl victory parade, and then he had to put his staff together. He's been working on that all weekend, and there are questions about what this team's going to look like going forward under the new Kellen Moore administration. WWL NFL analyst and co-host of Sports Talk, Mike Dettillier, is with us this morning. Mike, let's pick it up with the quarterback discussion. Many wondering, who's going to be Kellen Moore's quarterback, and do you anticipate that we'll find out this season, or do we have to wait another season till Kellen Moore gets the opportunity to install who may be his quarterback going forward?
You know what you have with Derek Carr. It's not going to be any better, okay? He's a guy that is always hovers around that 500 mark as a quarterback. And my thing is, if you know that and he's not your future, then move on. And all the options aren't good because of the salary cap implications with Carr. But I got a feeling that we're going to be seeing a lot of Spencer Rattler this year. I do think this football team goes out and gets a veteran quarterback. But is he the future of this team? No. So I think they're going to give Spencer Rattler every opportunity with this chance here in New Orleans for 2025. With Derek Carr, I think you know what you have. And it's not, it's going to be the same thing where he'll have good moments and then not good moments. You move off. If you know he's not going to be a big part of rebuilding this franchise and not going to be here in 2026, my deal is move off from it.
You know, I got a chance to talk to Spencer Rattler on Radio Row leading up to the Super Bowl, and he really felt like if he had a chance to work with the receivers in training camp, in preparation, and that they understood that they need to react differently to him versus a quarterback who stays in the pocket like Derek Carr, he really feels like with these receivers, he could have some success if they adapt their play to know that he is moving, he's rolling out, he's getting out of that pocket, and they need to move to a spot where he can throw them the ball.
Yeah, I think every quarterback feels that way, Dave, that they have a comfort zone with a wideout. They sort of both on the same page. And remember, for a good chunk of this season, the Saints were without both Chris Olave and Rashid Shaheed, the two starting receivers. You had a difficult time from game to game to tell you who was going to play at wide receiver. You needed, you know, basically a press guide to look at their resume. So that has a lot to do with it. And also, too, offensive line play. Because I can always recall Zach Streif telling me, you know, about he was just so fortunate that he played all those years with Drew Brees. Because he said, I always sort of knew where he was in the pocket. And we were watching a game with Ben Roethlisberger, and he was like, I would have hated to play with him. Because every play,
you never know what you're going to get.
you don't know where he's going to be, because he had roaming sort of feet. He would move left, move right, move up. And I do think that is part of it, too. People don't realize it's like a well-orchestrated dance group. And if you're out of place, everybody notices it. And that includes offensive line play. So I agree with Spencer Rattler. I think most quarterbacks, they want that cohesiveness with themselves along with the offensive line and also their own receivers. And Spencer didn't have that.
No, he started like six games, but he never really got a chance to practice with that offensive squad and have them adapt to his style of play. Very quickly, Mike, obviously Coach Moore is going to be looking to make a splash in free agency or the draft. One or two names we should keep an eye on?
Well, free agency, it'll be real short. I don't think this team has a ton of money to do it. It'll be rebuilt through the draft, and you got to go with big men. I still think offensive, defensive line, tight end.
All right.
And that's where you should look at.
We'll get more from Mike on Sports Talk tonight here on WWL. Back with Jeff Palermo, LSU Baseball next. 7:16 on this President's Day, 2025. It was an opening weekend sweep for the LSU Tiger baseball team, but the competition against the Mastodons maybe not a real measure of what this Tiger team has in store. So I want to talk to Jeff Palermo to find out how this team is shaping up, and at least on paper, how the LSU baseball team looks, particularly compared to last year's squad. Morning, Jeff.
Hey, Dave, how you doing today?
It's Monday. It's President's Day, one of those weird holidays where it's not really a holiday, but we don't get mail, and, you know, so we can go buy a mattress. So there is that. What did you think of what you saw on the diamond from the Tigers over the weekend?
Well, Purdue-Fort Wayne, as I mentioned in my article on WWL.com, they're not going to be you're not going to confuse them with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Not a very good baseball team, but LSU did what you're supposed to do when you're ranked in the top five and you're taking on a team that's not nearly as talented as you. You completely dominate them, and that's exactly what they did, 32-2. But I think really what sticks out is the pitching. Just everyone that came on that mound over the weekend or that went on that mound over the weekend, they were outstanding. And the biggest thing is they threw strikes. They attacked the zone. Now, maybe they go into it knowing, hey, this is a team that's even if I throw it right down the middle, they're not going to hit it very far or not going to hit it very hard, so let me just attack the zone. But still, you got to go out there and do it. And that's exactly what LSU did. Everyone that took the mound threw strikes, and it and they ended up striking out, pretty impressive number, 45 strikeouts over the three-game series. That's the most in a weekend series in LSU history since 1992.
Wow, okay. And against lower competition, no doubt, a team most people have probably never heard of, which means they probably don't draw a whole lot of great recruiting. But nonetheless, you got to start somewhere, and that's where LSU started. Last year, there were questions about this pitching rotation, and they never could quite find the right combination.
Yeah.
Do you think that they've addressed some of those issues? Either through the transfer portal or developing younger players and finding a lineup that's going to work for LSU, hopefully to make a run back to Omaha?
Yeah, I mean, you look at it, you'll sit here and say, okay, it was just Purdue-Fort Wayne, LSU should strike them out, and this and that. But even if you go back to last year, I mean, LSU opened up the season playing VMI in Central Arkansas. And at VMI season opener, Thatcher Hurd didn't have a very good game. He gives up four runs in 2 2/3 innings, and it kind of set the tone for the entire season of how up and down his season was. Cam Johnson was a heralded freshman left-hander. He can't find a plate in his first appearance in that opening weekend. He walked 6-1 inning, and that set the tone for the rest of the season. So, yes, it's only three games that what we saw here, but what you saw is that this is a team that has.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and, for shoppers, buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
As a lot more pitching depth this year. I mean, every arm that LSU was bringing out of the bullpen was coming in and throwing strikes. Not only just the three starting pitchers in Cade Anderson and Anthony Ianson and then Chase Shores yesterday, but Cason Evans, Connor Benge, Maverick Rizzi comes in the ninth inning on Saturday.
Name.
Yeah,
Maverick
awesome name.
Rizzi.
He's missing the E in the first name. I'm not sure what's going on with that, but still, it's awesome name. Maverick Rizzi comes in the ninth inning and just blows him away. We got to see William Schmidt yesterday, the heralded freshman from Catholic High in Baton Rouge, and he lived up to the expectation, at least in that one outing. So there is a lot of depth. You know, even the national championship season, LSU was only counting on like five or six pitchers by the end of the year. This year, Jay Johnson's hoping it's more like eight or ten pitchers.
All right, so the pitching stronger for LSU this year, and maybe the strongest it's been in a long time. What about the hitting? We'll talk to Jeff Palermo about that coming up after this on WWL. You can read much of his analysis online at WWL.com. We're back with Jeff talking about the offense for your LSU Tiger baseball team after we check in on WWL traffic. 7:24, I'm usually on the 5 o'clock hour, 7:24, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker, and Jeff Palermo is with us, WWL LSU columnist. Jeff, we talked about how the pitching looked much improved this year for the LSU Tigers and a far deeper bullpen. What about hitting? The Tigers struggled at times last season finding the right lineup and getting the guys in the right order to put runs across the plate. How do you like the way the offense is shaping up for the LSU baseball team this season?
Well, one of the reasons why I think LSU's offense was so inconsistent last year is they were really struggling to find a leadoff man. You know, Dylan Cruz was that guy in 2023, and he got on base like 45% of the time, and it set it up for LSU's big boppers, and LSU offensively was one of the greatest offensive teams in college baseball, but they struggled last year finding that leadoff man. And Chris Stanfield may be the answer this year. He's a transfer from Auburn. He's playing center field. Now, I'm not going to tell you he's going to get on base 45% of the time, but he's a guy that can get on base. And then when he does get on base, he's got some speed. And that could be a big part of LSU offensively. Because Jared Jones is certainly going to hit his share of home runs. He hit a monster home run on Saturday. But one of the big questions going into the season is, where else is the power going to come from LSU? Now, they hit three home runs on Saturday. Derek Curiel, the talented freshman left fielder, he hit one. That was good to see. But it was just nice to see LSU put the ball in play. There were a couple of opportunities where they had chances to score some runs, and they weren't able to do it. But that's going to happen, obviously, during the course of the season and even a course of a weekend. But I thought it was really great debuts for Dickinson. He had five RBIs in the season opener. He's from Utah Valley State, and he was a guy that hit for a high average last year, and he ended up having five hits. Mentioned Chris Stanfield, Derek Curiel. And then yesterday, LSU, I think it was they didn't score in the first three innings, and then Ashton Larson hits a three-run homer, and that kind of opens up the floodgates against Purdue Fort Wayne yesterday. And Ashton Larson's in a very interesting spot in that he was one of LSU's better hitters in SEC play as a freshman, but right now he's behind a couple of other guys. I mean, he didn't start until Sunday, so he's behind like Jake Brown and Josh Pearson and those guys like that. And he's going to have to really fight to get at bats. But when you're hitting, you know, three-run bombs like he did on Sunday, it's going to be hard to keep him out of the lineup. So that was I thought it was a big game for him. And we'll see where it goes from here as far as how Jay Johnson continues to construct the lineup.
So do you expect this team to be more of a small ball LSU squad or a gorilla ball squad?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be gorilla ball, but I think it could be more of a mix. I really do. I mean, Jared Jones does have the possibility of hitting 30 home runs this season. He certainly has that. But you know, last year you had guys like Hayden Travinsky and Tommy White, two guys that can, you know, smack it out of the ballpark as well. And it's hard to say, you know, who else is going to maybe hit, you know, 15 plus home runs on this team. You know, that remains to be seen. So it might be a mix. It might be, you know, a little bit more of a balanced offense between, you know, hitting home runs or going from first to third on a base hit or stealing some bases and this and that. And Jay Johnson has shown during his career, you know, going back to Arizona and even before that, is he'll play the style of baseball that fits his personnel.
LSU was a preseason top five team, depending on which poll you look at. There's so many baseball polls. But that being said, do you like this team's chances of making a run and getting back to Omaha for the College World Series?
It's all going to come down to pitching, Dave. And based on what we saw this opening weekend, LSU just has a bunch of arms. And when you have Chase Shores, a guy who can throw 99 miles an hour as your Sunday starter right now, you're in really good shape. And LSU, and a lot of LSU baseball teams have struggled to have that third starter on the weekend. And again, it's only been three games and it was not a very good opponent, but just looking at the talent and the stuff that these guys are bringing on the mound with them, it just looks like there's a lot more options here for Jay Johnson. And he hasn't, and again, he didn't have, I mean, he had Paul Skenes and Ty Floyd and a couple of other guys in 2023. But here, again, I think he has about 8 or 10 guys, and maybe even more than that, that he really feels comfortable with at this point. Now, there's going to be ups and downs, but a really good start for LSU.
Omaha or not?
Oh, I think that this should be a team that goes to Omaha. They certainly, it would be disappointing if they didn't.
Thank you. And what's disappointing is we've run out of time with you. Thank you, Jeff. Enjoy your President's Day. I know we'll be talking to you a lot throughout this baseball season as this LSU team makes a run to try and get back to the glory land. He's Jeff Palermo. Read more of his commentary at WWL.com. I'm Dave Cohen. We'll get Mark Rosa in here to help you manage your money and see what the markets are doing. Well, they're closed today, but we'll be doing when they reopen after the holiday after this on WWL. 7:45 on your President's Day, Monday, means the markets are closed, but that doesn't mean we're not going to take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street, as we always do on Mondays, with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Hey, Mark.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Is the credit union closed today because of the holiday?
No, sir. We're open.
Yeah, it's such a weird holiday. You know, usually we could always count on federal holidays, banks and the post office being closed, but now you never know if the bank's open or not. Your bank is open. All right. Wall Street is closed.
We are open. Yes, sir.
So
Wall Street is closed.
Yes, because all those Wall Street investors, I'm sure, are paying homage to presidents today.
That's right. That's what they're doing right now.
Yes.
Everybody lined up.
Yeah, inflation. We heard a lot about inflation during the presidential campaign, promises that inflation would come down if President Trump was elected. So far, that has not happened, and inflation continues to be a serious issue.
Dave, you know, every 2 weeks, we get bathed in new inflation data, and I'm sure everybody within the sound of my voice is about as sick of it as I am. You just keep talking about it, keep talking about it. We wonder how it's going to shape the markets. But, I mean, it's just been such an issue since they flooded the markets with money a couple of years ago to the tune of several trillion dollars. It ignited inflation, and it's just not going to go away very easily. And I think the economy has been very resilient, and it's the markets hit all-time highs right after the election. And I don't know if that was just getting the election behind them, or they were excited about the result, or maybe both. But the Dow eclipsed 45,000, and then it retreated a bit when the Fed came out and said, you know, we were talking about two interest rate cuts in 2025, but, well, we don't know yet. You know, we're going to have to posture ourselves to wait and see. So since the market came back about 3,000 points, and it's been edging up because we've really had positive economic news. We've had, like, last week industrial production was up and capacity utilization was up, and earnings for the majority of the S&P 500 companies that have reported earnings have reported better than expected earnings, like 70% or higher of those companies. So two things to determine stock prices: interest rates and corporate earnings. They've had a lot of the fuel from the latter, that companies are doing well, their balance sheets are doing well, and consequence, stocks generally go up after that sequence of events. But here comes, okay, the much anticipated, we have January inflation numbers that were released last week. and the CPI consumer prices were up greater than the consensus estimate, supposed to come in at 0.3%, and it came in at 0.5. What does that mean? 0.5 for 1 month, you multiply it by 12 to annualize the data, and that on, now not one number does a trend make, but that is a 6% annual inflation number, and the Fed is looking for 2. Well, that's a far departure from, you know, what they wanted to see. So then we wait another day for the producer price index, wholesale pricing. That was supposed to come in at 0.3%. It came in at 0.4%. So all these numbers are not the highest numbers in the world, but if they keep persisting, if month after month we're seeing some of these numbers that are just stubborn, they're not. Every now and then we get a 0.2 or a 0.1 for the month, and that's fantastic. Again, multiplying 0.2 times 12 would be 2.4% annual rate. And, you know, that's pushing it in the way that the Fed wanted to go, and maybe the market would see some relief with not just the corporate earnings coming in higher than expected, but we'd get some relief off of interest rates that they ratcheted up over 5% in the course of their ratcheting process. So it's, okay, well, now what happens? Well, the Fed didn't like this. It makes them sit up straight. It's like, well, we're going to have to wait and see. So this week is that everybody is on the edge of their seats to wait. Since we had disappointing, quote-unquote, inflation news, people are waiting to see what the Fed minutes are going to reveal about last week's meeting. And it's like, okay, are they planning on no interest rate decrease? Just if everybody wants to digest what those minutes are saying, and that's going to be the minutes of the last meeting. So it gives a lot of insight as to what they're thinking. But over the weekend, I saw some information that said, you know, five things about persistent inflation. And we do have a reasonably strong economy. At 4% unemployment rate, it ticked down over the last couple of announcements. And more employment means more spending, and people are spending their money like they always would do. Services are expensive, and people are not just buying the normal services like I need my grass cut. The consumer discretionary spending has been up over the past couple of months. What does that mean?
Well, let's hold it right there. When we come back, we'll find out what that means. And we'll talk about how much can a president control the economy, despite we always hear promises during campaigns, but how much influence does a president really have on the economy? I'll ask Mark that coming up. And do we get back to Dow 45,000? We were there late last year, but that was, you know, before President Trump took office. Now we've been trying to get back to it. All of that coming up with Mark Rosa after the traffic. So we saw the markets surge a bit after the election, then dip, and then start to climb again after the inauguration, but still not back to where they were. Mark Rosa is with us for our Monday Morning Markets with Mark segment, even though Wall Street is closed today for President's Day. Mark, are we headed back to Dow 45,000 anytime soon?
Dave, I think the market is just waiting for a catalyst to bring stock prices higher. And every time we have some supportive economic information, like I was discussing before, earnings news came out. Then you got the Fed saying, well wait, hold the phone. We might have to step in and do something about this nagging inflation. You know, they were the consumer discretionary I was talking about before. Those are, you know, the things that people don't have to spend money on. It's not the food on the table. It's like luxury items. It's like, you know, cruises. It's airplane tickets. It's those things that we've seen go up, and, you know, with a 4% unemployment rate, people are working. So a lot of this keeps the demand push side of it. People are demanding goods and services, so it keeps prices high. And what the Fed was saying was, well, we want to get the unemployment rate to like 6. This is back when they were doing their rate raising regime, and it's like, well, that'll bring some things down. Yeah, you'll crush demand. And with the same supply, the economics of it would be that the prices would start coming down. But they would say, well, we don't want to create a recession in the process. So they were wanting the perfect world, the Goldilocks economy. And while they brought us to where we are with careful monetary policy changes, meaning interest rate changes, and if everybody was saying late last year, we got the Goldilocks, we got a soft landing. But it's not quelling the inflation. So the only thing that has helped with this, it seems like each month, Tommy and I talk about the wages that have steadily gone up to meet the higher prices. So it's not like wages stayed stagnant a couple of years ago and prices keep going up, then you'd have stagflation. Some economists have worried about that. But it's like we're not, I don't think we're heading in that direction yet. The economics doesn't point in that direction yet, but that's the troubling part. So the market is at continual wait and see. It gets a few little spurts of energy and enthusiasm, and then it backs itself down. So as of last Friday, it was 44,006 and change. And it's just kind of been in that trading range, waiting for more economic news.
And I'm waiting for my 401k to take a significant jump very quickly, Mark.
Oh, yes, sir.
How much can a president do to influence the economy? We got about 30 seconds.
Well, if he can't, if he walks in and says, look, I'm going to cut banana prices in half effective today. Well, that's not going to move the economy. What really needs to happen is something that touches everything. Always said that if we could get fuel prices down, oil's around $70 a barrel, if that would fall significantly, it would touch everything through the economy in a good way.
So it's very difficult, even though we heard all the promises during the campaign, for President Trump or any other president, for that matter, to significantly influence the economy.
Well, and I think that's where the drill, baby, drill comments were coming, because energy would touch every single thing, and that would be a focus for the administration.
Yeah, but the oil company's not so much on board. Thank you, Mark. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you on Friday. Coming up next, we'll talk about the cost of homes. 8:14 in for Tommy Tucker on this President's Day. Glad you're with us. Keep the text coming. I'll read some of them coming up a little later about this report you heard in the news about whether or not our pets truly love us the way we love them. Do you think your pets love you, or do they just see you as someone to pet them, feed them, give them treats, and as a resource? Ali Bustamante is a UNO professor in the Department of Economics and Finance and director of the Division of Business and Economic Research, and has done some research on housing costs here locally and nationwide. Good morning, Professor. Happy President's Day.
Good morning. Happy President's Day.
I'm glad you could be with us. Inflation has definitely been one of the most troublesome and difficult things that we've been dealing with now for really the last several years. And people have been feeling the pain, but housing prices have outpaced the inflation we're seeing in other parts of the economy, haven't they?
Absolutely. In fact, when we think about inflation overall, which is to say, you know, the overall increase in prices, housing is really a key element that is actually causing a lot of these pressures. As you mentioned, you know, it's really the biggest and largest pinch that folks are really feeling these days.
Yeah, and for most people, it's the biggest single payment they make every month, whether it's toward their mortgage or toward their rent. That's the one thing. You need a roof over your head. And for most people, now I know car prices have gotten to a point, and trust me, I went car shopping last week, to a point where cars now, new cars in many cases, cost more than some homes, and definitely more than the first home I bought, but we'll stick to housing. It is the biggest portion of a lot of people's monthly expenses. How much have housing prices increased?
I mean, it really is right now when we're first off and over the year, when we think about what's actually driving the increase in overall prices, about 30% of that, it has to do with housing. It's really not just, you know, home ownership in terms of mortgages and home insurance, but also rents. And when we're looking at, you know, relative to where we were just, you know, 3-4 years ago, you know, with the pandemic, we've seen housing prices increase almost to about 20%.
My goodness. So your rent, your mortgage, when you include all of the other costs, when you're talking about housing, you are also talking about insurance and utilities and everything else that goes along with living in a house or an apartment.
Yes, we are. And, you know, we actually have the ability to disaggregate that. But really across the board, as you mentioned, you know, we know very well here in Louisiana, you know, home insurance prices have just like skyrocketed overall. But it really is, you know, housing, as you mentioned, you know, it's the largest expense that most people have. And that's really the biggest pinch that folks are feeling. Although I also mentioned that over the year, we've actually seen some considerable increases in both obviously food prices as well as gasoline over time.
Yeah, I'm not discounting the other parts of the inflationary calculation, but housing clearly a big problem. And you talk about it's responsible for 30% of the inflation we've seen, and the average person is paying 20% now more for housing than they were just a short time ago. So why have housing costs gone up so dramatically?
Well, there's really two key parts. One of them is the fact that interest rates are really high. You know, interest rates have been, right now your 30-year mortgage is most likely going to be over 7%. And a lot of that is not just impacting the cost of homeownership itself in terms of getting a mortgage, but also the cost of development. So there's a lot of developers who are really reticent to break ground on new projects with these interest rates so high.
You know, on one hand, I was excited. I sold a house 3 years ago and got dramatically more for that home than I paid for it because of the housing inflation. But, of course, I had to then go buy another home. So I went from seller to buyer, not so happy as a buyer as I was for as a seller.
And that's, in fact, something that we're, you know, that I think a lot of folks are really, really aware of right now. The fact that if they do sell their home, you know, they might be facing a lot higher mortgage rates than they were previously paying, as well as just the overall, much higher valued market than they had, you know, when they probably first purchased that house several years ago. And so that's actually another factor that is really contributing to housing prices remaining stubbornly high. The fact that there's just a lot of folks who, you know, might be thinking twice before selling their homes.
We're talking with Professor Ali Bustamante at UNO about the dramatic increases we've seen in the cost of housing, both rents, mortgages, insurances, and everything else that it goes into what you pay to keep a roof over your head. When we come back, I'm going to ask him, what does the future look like? Do we see anything on the horizon that suggests we're going to stop seeing these dramatic increases in what it costs for a home, whether that's insurance rates, interest rates, property values, or anything else that's going to help in that regard? I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. We're back with Professor Bustamante after we take a look at WWL traffic. Professor Ali Bustamante is with us at UNO as we're talking about how housing costs have dramatically skyrocketed, outpacing other inflationary costs that we've been dealing with over the last several years. 20%. Increases in housing costs, which is responsible for nearly a third of all of the inflation we've been dealing with. Professor, does the future look any brighter in terms of slowing this inflation?
Well, you know, there's really two key parts that are going to shape what the next couple of years looks like. One is interest rates. The unfortunate part is that right now the Federal Reserve was on track to continue to cut interest rates, which again was going to ease some of this pressure that has been that a lot of developers and a lot of folks have been feeling about, you know, driving higher prices up, as well as preventing the new development of a lot of new housing. That being said, with a lot of the trade uncertainty right now, the Federal Reserve is on path to actually slowing, if not, you know, at least temporarily pausing interest rate cuts. And so that's really one factor where it's really not till we get much lower interest rate cuts, much lower interest rates, that we're actually going to see some of these pressures ease. The second part, as we kind of mentioned, is, you know, when are folks going to feel a lot more comfortable listing their homes? So it's really a chicken or egg thing where, you know, it's when folks really feel, you know, that the economy is doing, you know, extremely well enough that they're able to sell their homes and find a new home at a relatively reasonable price, that they're going to increase that housing supply as well.
Yeah, so with the Fed's efforts to right the economy include slowing down interest rate cuts, that may be helpful to some sectors of the economy, but it really is not to the housing sector.
Exactly right. So, you know, if your savings account is going to have much higher returns than it otherwise would, but when it comes to, and, you know, and actually, you know, your housing prices might continue to go up in terms of, you know, if you're a homeowner, you know, your home values are probably going to continue increasing. That being said, it really provides no relief to the folks who are buyers right now, either facing a limited supply of housing options or high interest rates.
Yeah, it's not easy. And nonetheless, you need a roof over your head. You can't pitch a tent and call it a day. At least most of us cannot. So I guess we'll just have to continue to follow the bouncing ball and hope for the best. Professor Bustamante, any final thoughts before I let you run?
As I mentioned, right now it's a bit of uncertain economic times, but, I feel optimistic that we can actually get to a place where we have, the Federal Reserve cutting these interest rates and really easing a lot of these tensions.
Thank you, Professor. We appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your President's Day. I'm not sure how you're supposed to observe President's Day, but, go feel presidential, I guess.
Great.
Or buy
Thank
a mattress.
Thank you so much.
Right. All right. Thank you, Professor. Professor Ali Bustamante at UNO. We heard in the news a new survey out on whether or not pet owners believe their animals truly love them the way humans love each other, and an overwhelming majority of pet owners believe they do. Others, though, are maybe a little bit more pragmatic and realize that many animals, their entire focus really is just on positive reinforcement, and they will, quote unquote, love whoever feeds them, whoever pets them, whoever provides them with the things that they want, the treats, the toys, and so on. One text comes in on the Oakwood Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870. Says, Dave, I believe our pets do love us. Had a cat that when I was sick, she would jump on my bed and lay by me. She never did that any other time. She knew I wasn't feeling well, so I saw it as a sign that she was trying to comfort me and did indeed love me. Now, this says, Dave, I believe pets do love humans. That's why there is often such a deep connection and why humans feel such deep love back. You give love when you get love and vice versa. And I get that feeling. I understand that. But at the same time, I don't know that they love us the same way that we love a human. I don't know that they have the same sort of longing and missing if we go away that we have if we lose some human that we love. I believe that it's a far more quickly replaceable kind of love that I know. And I've owned many dogs and many cats and other animals. But I know even my current cat who, the minute I come home, comes running to me, and I do give him a treat because, well, he comes running to me, and as soon as I sit down on the couch, he jumps up, and I pet him, and he purrs, and it's all wonderful. And I've had dogs, similarly, that get so excited when I come home. But I think I know deep down that, really, if I stop coming home, whoever did start coming home, as long as they provided them with the food and the treats and the petting, that they'd probably very quickly love them just as much. I hope the same isn't true about my wife if suddenly I were gone. I'm Dave Cohen. Coming up next half hour, we're going to talk a little bit more about Mardi Gras. How'd the first weekend go? And what's ahead for these cold parades this weekend? And any changes you need to be aware of now that we're diving into the depths of the carnival celebration. That's all after the news on WWL. 8:46, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. He'll be back tomorrow. He's out observing President's Day, I presume. Didn't really ask him where he was going to be today, so I don't know. I do know where Arthur Hardy is today. The founder of the Mardi Gras Guide is right here with us at WWL. Morning, Arthur.
Good morning. I know where Tommy is.
Oh, yeah?
Yep, he's got his chair out for the Endymion Parade on Orleans Avenue.
He's already lining up, holding down the best spot. It's going to be a rough weather ride if he's going to sit out the whole time between now and then.
Yeah, but he'll have a great spot, right?
And then people will show up at the last minute and stand right in front of him. So it's just how it works.
That's how it goes, yeah.
Man, I got to go to the Titans Parade in Slidell Friday night. And the Driftwood Parade in Kenner on Saturday, two very different celebrations, but both very enthusiastic and everyone had a great time. This first weekend, a little different this year because of Super Bowl. Things aren't exactly where they belong. I was trying to make it out to Little Rascals on Sunday to see how that crew has revived itself and didn't make it. So, but how was this first weekend before the big two weekends?
You know, it's been terrific from everything that I've seen and experienced. This used to be almost a dead weekend, and now, I mean, this being the one that just passed us, you know, you've got so many different choices to make from boat parades to kid parades to, you know, parades in Slidell and the Marinette. I mean, it was just a great weekend. But officially, the parade season, according to ordinance at Orleans and Jefferson, starts this coming Friday. And, you know, there are more parades on this weekend than on Fat Tuesday weekend. And that used to not be the case. You know, you would ramp up to the big weekend. Not anymore. 18 parades this weekend and 15 on Fat Tuesday weekend. And by the way, 1 year from the day will be Fat Tuesday 2026. How about that?
All right. We're 1 year away from the next Fat Tuesday, but we still got a couple of weeks till this year's Fat Tuesday. So we'll look forward to that. But an earlier Fat Tuesday next year. Why do you think it is that this weekend now, and I have a theory, but I want to hear yours. Why do you think it is that the weekend before the pre-Fat Tuesday weekend now has more parades than the Fat Tuesday weekend?
Well, two reasons. There weren't many openings on the weekend before Fat Tuesday. You know, in Orleans Parish, it's frozen. You're not going to get a new permit there. And it's just a lot. It's a calmer weekend. And let me tell you, visitors have caught on to this, that hotel rooms are less expensive, parking's easier. This is almost like the locals' weekend. So it's become more popular, or as popular, I should say, more in terms of the quantity of parades. But I mean, I remember as a kid, it was Carrollton Sunday, and that was pretty much how it started.
Yeah.
And now, my goodness, it's wall-to-wall parades. But,
and some really good parades and some really great activities. Family Gras has really blossomed in Jefferson Parish, and they sought to make the weekend before the Fat Tuesday weekend where to be was Jefferson and Veterans Memorial Boulevard. But I think the city has now added some great parades this weekend as well. I feel like the people who ride in parades love to ride this weekend, but next weekend they love to go to the Super Cruise. So maybe
exactly
that's why we have more parades this weekend than next weekend.
Well, that's a good thought. And, you know, you could on the Uptown Parade route on Saturday, you could plop down a folding chair and see six parades, and I added it up, 124 floats. I mean, that's a whole season, right?
This Saturday.
So, yep. Quite a day. So we're looking forward to it, and I hope to see as much as I can. I can't get around like I did when I was 25, but I'm still out there enjoying it. You know?
Yeah, you may not hit every ball, every party, every parade, and every activity this time around. We're talking with the founder of the Mardi Gras Guide, Arthur Hardy. When we come back, I want to ask him about changes that we can expect this year to our Mardi Gras celebrations. We'll do that after we check on WWL traffic. 8:55, Mardi Gras Guide founder Arthur Hardy is with us. Arthur, what changes should people expect if they're heading out to parades the next two weekends?
Well, there's some route and date changes. You know, Alice moved into the spot formerly occupied by Knicks, and they'll follow Druids on Wednesday. Alice had been the third parade of a triple header. This coming Friday, they would be rolling, and they've been ending at like 1 in the morning. So they're welcome.
It was a late night.
Yeah. So that's big. The Crew of Kings is back in that area. They're off a couple of years, and they're going to go on Lundi Gras. But in terms of the thing that most people were concerned about is the enforcement of these new rules that says no canopies or tents or open flame grills on neutral grounds. The city seems to have backed off a little bit on enforcement, kind of indicating the police have more important things to do. So I think they've kind of put a pause on that, or at least said it's at the discretion of the police officer. So I don't think we're going to see the enforcement that perhaps had been planned of these new rules, which are, you know, game-changing. I mean,
if you were telling people they can't grill, they can't boil, they can't barbecue, they can't do any of those things on the parade route, that really changes the complexity the whole feel of the parade route.
Yeah, it changes the experience. So we'll see. Maybe there'll be some, undoubtedly there'll be some conversation in the off-season about it, but technically those laws are still on the books that you can't do those things, and it's up to the police to decide if they have the manpower, willpower, and need to enforce them.
We also expect to see, if anyone went to the French Quarter for the Super Bowl, similar types of security in the French Quarter, particularly on Bourbon Street, that we saw for the Super Bowl, as they're continuing in the wake of the New Year's Day terror attack, the SEER 1 federal authorities overseeing the security for Mardi Gras this year. Hopefully that doesn't change the whole feel of the celebration, but it does keep everyone safe.
Well, and I think the parades in general will never have had more security than this year. And some of it you may not see. You don't want the bad guys to know what they're doing, but you will see a lot of police presence on the street and drones. And, you know, I think it's going to be the safest ever. But, you know, let's be honest, it's impossible to completely secure a 5 mile parade route, you know.
Yeah.
But we'll do the best we can. And Mardi Gras goes on. You know, we've had things happened in the past that we didn't like, but here we are. Huh? It's Mardi Gras in New Orleans, and we do it.
Yeah, interestingly, at the Super Bowl parade, you saw armored military vehicles along the route with machine gun holding soldiers on those military vehicles, but they also had beads around their neck and hanging from their vehicles, and so it was, they weren't all business, but they were there to keep us safe. It's going to be a cold weekend this weekend. We don't know about next weekend yet, but we're talking about like 40s and 30s during parades Friday and Saturday.
Bring it on. Bring it on. As long as it's not wet, bundle up and get out there. Come on.
Yeah, Sunday too. The only thing I think, the winds are going to be a little high. That may be an issue, catching throws. That's the most frustrating thing is when you see someone on a float trying so hard to get you that throw, and then the wind takes it and blows it far off the course.
It happens.
Arthur, folks can pick up your Mardi Gras guide now?
Yeah, it's everywhere, and we think we have a good issue. I guess the public will decide that, but I'm happy to do it. This is our 49th. Next year will be the big one, 50, assuming I'm still above ground.
All right. Well, let's try to make that happen. Saturday Night Live made 50 last night. They celebrated it. Let's celebrate 50 years of the Mardi Gras guide with you next year.
Let's do it.
1 year from one year from today is Fat Tuesday. All right. It'll be February 17th next year, not till March 4th this year. So there we go.
Happy Mardi Gras.
Thank you, Arthur. Arthur Hardy here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Coming up next hour, I want to continue this conversation. Do pets really love us? We'll pick it up there, and we'll take a closer look at the freezing weather we're getting at the end of this week. Ridiculous character. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Oh, look at that. We've got a professor who wants to sound off on this new survey that finds most people who have pets believe their pets can truly love them. Phil Dedeschi is a professor at the University of Denver. Professor, thanks for joining us here on WWL.
Yeah, thanks for having me this morning.
I know we can't clinically, absolutely, one way or another, prove it, but we're having a pretty good debate here this morning about this survey that found most people who have pets believe their pets truly do love them the way humans love one another. Others, though, who believe that, well, I think if I disappeared today, whoever showed up with the toys and the treats and the petting and the food would probably get the same exact interaction with my dog, my cat, or whatever pet that I did. What do you think, as a professor who studies such things at the Graduate School of Social Work Institute of Animal Science and Protection, Sentience and Protection?
Yeah. Sentience and protection. Well, thanks for inviting me to come on. This particular survey that Rover did is an interesting one, and they have they've done this a few years where they've gathered information that gives us insight into these relationships between people and their companion animals. And my work in animal sentience would suggest that animals, much like ourselves, have the capacity for, deep emotional experiences and complex thoughts. And so even the framing of your question, I think, when we think about treats or, protection, food or toys, those sorts of things as being somehow mediators in this process, I think what we'd find is that that's true for most animals, including human animals, right? If you didn't get cared for,
I would hope my wife would take a little longer to find a replacement for me than would my current cat. I've had cats and dogs over the years, and my current cat, I really does like me. I know that. But I just think very quickly, if I were to not come home tomorrow, whoever did would suddenly fill that role very quickly.
Yeah, well, I mean, what we really have evidence of, and really this year has been a remarkable year to study this because of the New York University's put out this declaration on animal consciousness, and it was a compelling piece of research, really signed by many of the world's scientists who study animal cognition and emotion. Is that animals are capable? Most animals are capable of this emotion. Whether it's identical to the way human beings would respond, I think, is a whole different question. We know that animals do grieve, for example, do feel deep sadness or loss, and in some cases, animals can't even survive because of the level of sorrow or grief that they may experience.
And people are sending us stories about animals who lay on the grave of the human being who cared for them for many years and who grieve at the gravesite. And in fact, I know that my brother-in-law's dog, when my brother-in-law passed, he did that. And there we hear about that over time, and then that there is that deep connection, particularly in death.
That's right. Yeah. And I think a lot of people have those stories or seen that. And one of the ways that we understand human behavior or these kind of questions is by studying the animal's behavior itself, right? That's how animals communicate what's happening with them. And if we study the behavior, oftentimes what we're really observing are reactions, you know, a wide range of emotions. We see joy, you know, we see enthusiasm. All of us have experienced that idea of coming home and being greeted, you know, when we walk through the door in these uniquely, you know, enthusiastic ways. But we'll also see animals at the other end, see fear or concern or anxiety or sadness when they have experienced losses. Even with their other animal friends, we sometimes will see deep changes in their behaviors that suggest that they're experiencing strong emotions.
So do you believe that it is the same kind of emotions that humans express for each other? We just can't, they can't verbalize it. So that's why we're having this debate?
Well, the way I look at it would be, first of all, that, you know, human beings are relatively lazy communicators in some ways, right? We only use words, you know, spoken or written or texted or emailed words to communicate with one another. Other animals use everything but, you know, the linguistic approaches. They use a lot of other forms of communication. They do vocalize at times, but they're using a lot of other kinds of information to communicate. And then I think the other thing we need to recognize is that it's probably an unfair measuring stick, right? Does an animal have to have human emotions for them to be emotions? And really what the evidence suggests is that most other animals actually do have the capacity for emotional response and a wide range of emotional experiences and complex thoughts. Whether they're identical to human beings, I think, is an unnecessary measuring stick, really, the way I look at it. They have their own ways of expressing it, and it's just as authentic and just as real.
Yeah, obviously many differences between humans and other animals. We know that, and I think that's an interesting point. But the question was asked. We didn't ask the question, as you know. The poll did. Maybe it is an unfair question, but either way, you believe through your studies in animal sentience and protection that indeed animals do have a higher level emotional response than just the responding to the alpha or just to the person who provides them protection and food and the like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question about it, really. I mean, I think even when we look not just at companion animals, but other animals, other domestic animals and wild animals as well, they have complex ways that they experience the world around them that include a wide range of ways of expressing themselves. And it is much more than just responding to, let's say, you know, a conditioned response to getting their food or getting their treats. I think there's really at this point, the jury's kind of back on that question. Whether or not human beings are willing to see it is a whole nother question that this survey didn't really ask. But I think one of the upsides of this kind of a survey is that it invites people to, you know, express how they're feeling about these relationships. And I think what it shows is that for many people, their relationships with non-human animals, their companion animals, are some of the most reliable and most consistent and important relationships in their lives.
You know, I was just somewhere the other day, and there was a man and his dog, and the man went outside to smoke a cigarette and left the dog inside. And the dog was just not happy and just like, you know, standing at the door and sniffing at the door and pawing at the door and just did not really want to be separated from this man at all. And it took me a few minutes to figure out why this dog was behaving that way. And then someone said, oh, well, he's outside smoking and they're never apart. And so that's clearly anecdotal. But do you have actual scientific evidence of these emotional responses? Is there any way to measure that through some sort of chemical levels in the blood or MRI of the brain or anything like that?
Yeah, both. Both of actually what you just described. When we do ethograms, which is a common way of studying behavior, we have, you know, numerous studies that document animals' expressions when they, for example, are separated from their own children, often are expressing, sadness, right, or concern or fear from being separated. Often vice versa, right? When children or babies of an animal are separated, you'll see strong reactions that are very parallel to what we might see, you know, in things like separation anxiety between a child and a parent. The situation that you just described, I think, is an interesting one in part because it also speaks to the what we call evolutionary continuity of these relationships. We've been co-evolving with dogs in particular, cats right behind them, but even other animals like horses, for example, are very familiar to people, and people are very familiar to them. Dogs are now seen as the smartest social animal relative to human beings and recognize small changes in the human affect or facial expressions, will, you know, be super observant of their person, often do. There's many dogs that feel upset about being separated from their person. In part, that relationship is so central to their own sense of well-being that they feel concerned or fearful or anxious and want to be closer. It's probably what makes pet keeping, you know, on the scale that we see it here in the United States, so intense. You know, we have 300 million plus animals living in people's homes, half of whom sleep on their beds every night. And people, you know, will tell us they sleep better when their animal is nearby, right? These are very reciprocal, mutually supportive relationships that are some of the most important relationships people have.
Talking with Phil Tedeschi, a professor at the University of Denver, if you have a question or comment about whether or not pets can love, call me and text me now on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line at 504-260-1870. It's interesting you say about dogs reading your facial expressions. One of my daughters has rescued two deaf dogs. And it's been very challenging because most communications between humans and dogs is verbal. Sit, stay, you know, those kinds of things. But she's had to learn to communicate with them where they can't hear her at all very successfully and down to a point where they do read the expressions on her face and know if she raises her eyebrows that that means something very different than if she smiles at them. And that's interesting you say that. At the same time, to say dogs are the second smartest, I'm hearing cat owners screaming at their radios right now. So that's where we'll pick up the conversation with Professor Phil Tedeschi after this. And take your calls and texts at 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Do your animals truly love you? Call me and text me now. We'll be back after this on WWL. 9:47, Dave Cohen with you, in for Tommy Tucker on this President's Day, 2025. Phil Tedeschi is with us. He's a professor at the University of Denver's Institute of Animal Sentience and Protection, talking about a new survey that finds overwhelmingly people who have pets believe their pets truly do love them back. Do you believe that pets have the ability to love? Professor Tedeschi, you said something interesting a moment ago, that there's growing evidence that dogs may be the second most intelligent beings on the planet after human beings. And that's
let me clarify that. When I said that, what I'm really referring to is in relation to understanding people. So we have, you know, we have evidence of other animals that have probably more, you know, significant IQ, much more greater intelligence, things like primates or whales and cetaceans, elephants, for example. But dogs have been co-evolving with people for so long that they understand the nuances of the way people function. And for example, you know, something as simple as pointing, or as you were describing, you know, your daughter's dogs that pay very close attention to her, you know, things like sign language or facial expressions. A lot of really much smarter animals don't do that. You know, if you lived with a non-domesticated canine like a wolf, you would find that they would not have the same, you know, capacity that our dogs do. But the average dog has really a very unique understanding about human beings.
There are clearly very different experiences that owners or people have, and people are upset with me for using the word owner, but parents or human companions, whatever word you want to use, with their dogs and their cats. I have owned dogs over the years. I felt like when my children were young, I had to have dogs, that it's just something important about growing up with dogs. I grew up with dogs. But now that my kids are all out of the house, we've migrated to cats because if we want to take a vacation for a week, we can just leave a pile of food, a big bowl of water, and a clean litter box, and the cats will be fine. But the cats interact very differently than do the dogs. Although some days the cats are very needy and want to snuggle and be pet and to sit in my lap. Other days they're fine just running around chasing a golf ball or whatever around the house. There are clearly differences between the way that we interact with our dogs and our cats.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, they're very different species and they have different needs and different, you know, ways of expressing themselves. I think, you know, one of the things that's new work, this survey, but kind of the deeper exploration into animal consciousness has taught us, however, is that, you know, even within a species like human beings, we are individuals. And so we have different reactions, different needs, different likes and dislikes. When we look at dogs, even we have to be careful about the same kind of generalizations. When we say all golden retrievers are good family dogs, well, that isn't always true. You'll see some of those dogs do great and, you know, have those same kinds of patterns of behavior that allow us to say that. But other dogs actually don't like children, right, or don't particularly have an affinity for some of those same reactions. And cats are very unique and distinct from dogs as a species, but then they're also within that, you know, individuals. I've met people who walk their cats on a leash outdoors like a dog, other cats who don't like the idea of going out at all, right, and things like that. In general, cats tend to be less oriented towards the concept or kind of need for a family pack, and more focused on the fact that their home or the geography around them and the people that live in that home are members of that environment. So there are times where they want to be close and connect. And there's also times where they want to be really independent, which is why, you know, if a cat doesn't want to even be found in your home, sometimes you don't even know where they are. Whereas a dog tends to often, you know, be very close to you, want to walk with you back and forth to the refrigerator, right, or to the to wherever they want to be nearby. So we'll see different species-specific behaviors, and we'll also see individual behaviors that let us know that each and every individual also has their own kind of perspective on the world around them.
Yeah, we have two cats now. One of them tries to get out the door at every opportunity. The other, if you open the door, she will not even put one paw over that. And if you carry her outside, she will cling to you like there's the end is near and cannot stand to be outside. So it's interesting. One person texts us on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870, says, absolutely dogs can love. My wife tells me when my car pulls into the driveway, my German Shepherd is already whining, crying, spinning around in circles, and until I open the door. Once I open the door, she's all over me and licks me as much as she can, and it's not because of food or needing to go outside. She has plenty of that. It's just because I'm home.
Yeah, isn't that great? Well, you know, and one of the most interesting studies on that very question around connection has to do with dogs' capacity for their capacity for smell, for olfactory information, and that it suggests that dogs can tell time, meaning that when you leave for work, your scent is much stronger when you're in the home. When you leave for work, your dog learns over time to recognize that as your scent dissipates over the day, by the time it gets to a certain level, that's about the time you're likely to be coming home. So we have some evidence that dogs can tell time through the capacity of recognizing scent.
Yeah, and some people wonder, because some people say that they, you know, they have in-home cameras now, and then when they get a block or two from their house, their dog starts going nuts. Like, they know that they're a block away, and they wonder, how do they know that I'm almost hearing the sound of my car? Are they smelling me that far away? How do they know?
Yeah, they probably are actually smelling the fact that your scent is less, actually. So they're going, it's about that time of day.
So we're creatures of habit, and we come home about the same time every day, and the dog figures that out. Somebody else says, dogs understand unconditional love far better than most humans. So there is that. Professor Tedeschi, thank you for joining us. Any final thoughts?
No, I was just going to say, I think that's the importance of this Rover survey, right, is that it teaches us that these relationships are really important and mutually beneficial.
Well, thank you so much. Go enjoy the day with your pets. You have cats, dogs, both?
I have both.
All right. Well, go enjoy the day with them. Hopefully you're off for President's Day, although most people are having to work. So there is that. Professor Phil Tedeschi, we appreciate your time here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen. I'll have some final thoughts and check in with Newell Norman, see what's coming up after this.